I would suggest that sometimes when we're trying to serve God, one of the things that really discourages our service to God is suffering. What does the Christian say in the midst of suffering that keeps them going? There's nothing that you can tell somebody that will just immediately make them okay emotionally with suffering. But one of the things that you can tell somebody is what John chapter 1 verse 11 says. And it says that he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. I find it interesting that the disciple that betrayed Jesus, his name was Judas. The tribe that Jesus came from was Judah, and in the Greek, those are the two same things. Almost like it's emphasizing the point that his own people betrayed him. There's a lot of religious people, a lot of founders of religions that certainly suffered, but none of them can rightly say that the guy that started their religion was somebody who was perfectly innocent and was also God come down from heaven into human flesh and was treated in all the most heinous ways you could imagine. We're going to look at this text in Mark chapter 15. This is the crucifixion scene. We're not going to look at the moment of his death. We're going to look at when Jesus is put on the cross and some of the interactions he has while he's on the cross. And I would suggest that this is one of the things that God has left us with to strengthen us when we don't feel like we've got the motivation to serve him. Look at Mark chapter 15, and we will read verses 16 through 32. Mark 15, verses 16 through 32. And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed, and spitting on him, and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. And they led him out to crucify him. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. And they brought him to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes mocked him to one another, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also reviled him. Now as we approach a text like this, I kind of think about what happened in Exodus chapter 3. When Moses saw the burning bush, and as he was getting closer, God says, "Moses, Moses, remove the sandals from your feet. This is holy ground." I know all of the text of the Bible is holy ground, but when you're looking at the crucifixion of the Messiah, we have to do the mental equivalent of taking the shoes off our feet and understanding that this is holy ground that we're looking at. When we look at this kind of text, I want to say a couple things that maybe help orient ourselves to what's happening here. For example, look at what Paul says about this moment in Philippians 2:8. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. And notice that he says, even death on a cross. What we just read about is one of the most humiliating things that could have happened to somebody in that time period, and really throughout history. And one of the things that I learn as Paul reflects on this scene is that the only kind of people that are going to follow Jesus' example here are going to be people who are humble. So you want to do what Jesus did. You want to go through the kinds of things that Jesus went through. You want to serve God to the extent that Jesus did. The only kind of person that will do that is a humble person. Notice another text, though, that relates to this one that we looked at. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1:23, "We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and a folly to Gentiles." Can you imagine Paul and the apostles preaching in this time period? And this message that they have is a stumbling block to Jews. The Jews were anticipating a Messiah that was going to destroy the Roman Empire and not be destroyed by the Roman Empire. And so here Paul is preaching in the synagogues in the book of Acts, and there's so many Jews that are rejecting it because it just doesn't make sense that their Messiah wouldn't conquer in a physical kind of way like they were expecting. But then Paul would be rejected by the Jews and go to the Gentiles, and he would have this message that to them was equally just as strange, and it was foolish to them. The Romans, you try to tell the Romans, hey, you guys crucified the king of the world. And the patriotism of the Gentiles may have made them say, there's no way we got that wrong. We wouldn't have crucified the wrong guy. Now, just time out for a second. If it was your mission to create a religion in the first century that was going to change the world, would you come up with a message that was a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles? Do you realize how countercultural Christianity was to its own day? The thing that we just read in Mark chapter 15, if you were going to make up a religion, you wouldn't have done this. This has got to be real. And as we look at this scene, there's a lot of ironic things that are happening here as well. You think about, for example, some of the kingly irony that's happening here. Jesus' claim was that he was the king. And ironically, in this text, people are proclaiming him to be the king in an ironic, mocking kind of way. You also have people, kings needing to be enthroned. In the Gospel of John, for example, Jesus will talk about his cross as being his hour of glory or his time of glory. It's almost like the cross became the place that he was enthroned on. And ironically, he's got his throne there. Another ironic thing about this is the attire. You've got the Romans giving him the purple, the scepter, the crown, and everything like that, going along with this idea that he's a king. But they're doing it all in an ironic way, but it's ironically true at the same time. Or you think about the ironic mocking that's happening here. In verse 29, the people are saying, "You said you could rebuild the temple in 3 days." Remember, we saw that in John chapter 2 yesterday morning. And they say, well, how about you come down now and start building that thing? And ironically, in order for the temple, which is his body, to be rebuilt in 3 days, he had to stay on the cross. Or, you look at verse 31, you've got these scribes and Pharisees that are mocking Jesus to one another. They can't even seem to look at him as they're mocking him. And they say, he saved other people, he did all of these good deeds, but he can't even save himself. Do you know what's ironic about that? The only way that Jesus was ultimately going to save people is if he didn't save himself and he stayed on the cross. And I learned something very important about that. Do you want to know how you transfer life to other people? The way that you give life to other people is for something in you to die. I've learned this more and more now that I have children. I got a 3.5-year-old. And I've learned that if I want him to thrive and I want him to live, part of my social life has to die. And part of my finances has to die. And a lot of my energy has to die. You want to know how Jesus helped us? By his wounds, we are healed. You want to know how you can help and bless other people? It will only come at sacrifice. It will only come at death of something in you. And so we see that going on ironically in this text. Now let me point out one thing that just helps orient ourselves to what's happening in this text. You notice that Simon of Cyrene is named in this text. It's not usual in the Gospel of Mark for you to see a personal name of somebody. But not only do we see Simon being named, but you've got Alexander and Rufus, his children, that are being named. And note that in Matthew and Luke, the parallel accounts, Matthew and Luke do not name Alexander and Rufus. Mark is the only Gospel that named the two sons. Have you ever wondered, you studied the Gospels and you see, well, how come this Gospel names these people, but the parallel account doesn't give the names of those people? Well, do we know anything else about Alexander or Rufus in the Bible? Not so much Alexander, but do you know where else Rufus is named, if it's indeed the same man? Romans chapter 16, verse 13, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord." The Gospel of Mark is written to a Roman audience. Romans is the book that mentions this man. You know what I think is going on here? If you wanted to know if this thing really happened and you were living in the first century, here's why I think Mark is naming Alexander and Rufus, because as he's writing to a Roman audience, those people could be sitting in the audience. If they got the scroll of Mark and they read it all together, somebody in the audience could have gone up to Rufus after that sermon and said, "Hey, Rufus, I just got a question for you. Did your dad really carry the cross?" And he could have said, "Yep, the things that we just read about really happened. My dad was there." Why else would he be named when he's not named in the other Gospels? Now, with that in mind, I want you to try to imagine what's happening in this scene here. At this point in the text that we're looking at, Jesus would have been scourged, which means his hands would have been tied to a post, and he would have been whipped with what they called a cat of nine tails, the whip that had chunks of metal and bone in it. And you can imagine him being lashed and lashed and lashed, and his back had all of this blood that's dripping out of it. And you've got these Roman guards, they're in the governor's headquarters, and the whole battalion is together. And they're treating Jesus like a play toy, putting on a purple robe, giving him a scepter. Did you notice what they put on his head, though? They twisted together a crown of thorns, they placed it on his head. The first time we read about thorns in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 3. It's one of the result of the curses. You know what Jesus is experiencing here? He's experiencing the brunt of the curses on his head. That's when the thorns were introduced into the world, and now they're on his head. And they're bowing down before him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews, Hail, King of the Jews," but the mocking gets ramped up, and they take this scepter, and they hit him over the head. When I was in junior high, I hit my head on the corner of a locker in the changing room. What are those places called? Locker room, that place. And it was just a small little hit on my head, and blood was just dripping down my forehead. Can you imagine how long those thorns would have been? And then with every single hit, there's all kinds of blood coming out of him. And then they start spitting on him. When I used to imagine this scene, or maybe you've seen it depicted in some movies, you might think that it's like, you know, maybe 10 soldiers that are spitting on him. But the text says in verse 19 that it was the whole battalion. Do you know how many people comprised a whole battalion? 200 people. I don't know if that literally meant you had 200 people spitting on Jesus, but can you imagine the spit just rolling off of him, fulfilling something that was written 600 years before. In Isaiah 50, verse 6, "I gave my back to those who strike, and my cheeks to those who pull out the beard. I hid not my face from disgrace and spitting." What we see going on in this crucifixion scene, there's kind of a convergence of all kinds of Old Testament prophecies that are being fulfilled in this moment. And after they treat Jesus like this, they take the purple clothes off of him, and you can imagine the blood that would have stuck to his back kind of reopens the wounds as they pull it off, and then he's led out to be crucified. Crucifixions happened outside the city. And so you can imagine that Jesus, he starts going towards Golgotha. And back then, what we know, it seems from archaeology and historical research, is that they wouldn't have carried the whole cross. They would have carried the cross beam, which is called the patibulum, or something like that. And Jesus would have gone out towards that place carrying this thing that could have weighed 150 pounds. John 19, verse 17, "And he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha." Have you ever wondered why it's called the place of the skull? I know some people have actually, a guy in Indiana a couple weeks ago sent me a text message showing me a picture of this location, and he was making the argument that it actually looks like a skull. And the picture kind of did look like a skull, but here's maybe another reason why this is called the place of the skull. Going back to Genesis chapter 3, do you remember the promise to Eve, about Eve and her descendants? That there was going to come a descendant one day that was going to crush the skull, or crush the head of the serpent. Where did that ultimately happen? The place of the skull, where Jesus was crucified. And so here's Jesus being led out to this place, but eventually, as he's carrying this, you can imagine how exhausted he is. And so they get Simon of Cyrene to help carry the cross. And as Jesus gets closer and closer, he's offered wine mixed with myrrh. Have you ever wondered why Jesus didn't take the wine mixed with myrrh? Well, maybe part of it is because he's going to experience the full brunt of everything, because that was an ancient kind of painkiller. But maybe here's another reason why Jesus didn't take the wine mixed with myrrh. Do you remember when he was instituting the Lord's Supper and he talks about the fruit of the vine and how he won't have it again until he has it new in the kingdom? Maybe one of the reasons that he denied it is because the kingdom hasn't been fully established yet, and it's not time to have something like that. But either way, as Jesus gets to the place of crucifixion, in verse 24, it just gives a couple simple words, "and they crucified him." You know, it's interesting in the Gospels, they don't really detail exactly what all of that would have meant, because the original audience knew what it would have meant. He was likely stripped completely naked. They would have put nails through his wrists on the crossbeam, and then lifted up the crossbeam, and then nailed his feet to the cross as well. And there he is, the Son of God, the only truly righteous, innocent man. And there he is being mistreated by all these people. And as he's on the cross, you've got these Roman guards who are treating him like he's some kind of gambling object, because they're rolling dice, essentially, for them to be able to get whatever possessions he has, fulfilling Psalm 22, verse 18. "They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." And as these people are up here, there's this a banner on the top of them that says, "The King of the Jews, King of the Jews." There he is, for all the people to see. By the way, the King of the Jews, that thing was written in all the languages. And part of maybe the idea of that is that Jesus' sacrifice were for people of all tongues and tribes. When you read all the Gospels accounts, we read that it was in different languages. But as Jesus is on the cross, you notice who else is crucified with him? Two robbers. I'm going to come back to that at the end of the lesson. But when you look at what's happening here, this scene makes sense of a lot of Old Testament passages to me, like this one. In Isaiah 53, this is the famous passage that we oftentimes read at the Lord's Supper. It says that he would be numbered with the transgressors. Well, what does that mean? He was going to be thought of as a transgressor. He was going to be counted among those kinds of people, and there he is, crucified with those people. Now, you imagine this scene, then. You've got Jesus in the middle, two robbers on either side. And as Jesus is on the cross, there's three waves of mocking. The first wave of mocking comes from the passerbys. Apparently, back then, people were crucified on roadways that people would commonly travel. And as they're looking at him, they're all looking at him and saying that you would rebuild the temple in 3 days. How about you save yourself? Come down. Now, I got a question about that. What kind of person looks at somebody who's bleeding out with nails driven through their wrists and feet and mocks them? What kind of person does that? And then you've got this second wave of mocking, and this comes from a little bit more of an unlikely source, because it's the chief priests and the scribes, and it says that they're mocking him to one another, so they're kind of high-fiving each other, you can imagine. Now, do you think the chief priests and the scribes were the kinds of people that typically would just pop some popcorn and go watch a crucifixion? They don't strike me as the kind of people that would typically go to something like this, but it seems like in this case, they're kind of reveling in their success of finally getting this guy that they were jealous of. You go back and read Mark 15, verse 10. They were envious of Jesus, and now they got him killed, they think. And so they're reveling in their success. Now, the third wave of mocking comes from the most unlikely source. You've got the two robbers. Can you imagine the two robbers? They're all kind of looking in at Jesus, and they're about to die too. And they're both mocking him. Now, we know from Luke's account, Luke 23, verses 42 and 43, and he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." One of them repented, and we're going to get back to that at the end of the lesson as well. But here's this scene, this bloody, gruesome scene that's filled with the love of God for us. What lessons can we draw from a scene like this? Maybe the first thing to think about with this is why Jesus suffered. If somebody was to ask you, okay, in this text, if you were just using this text, and you were trying to figure out, why did Jesus suffer, what would you say? Well, maybe if you look at the beginning of the text and the end of the text, notice how Jesus is being mocked. In verse 18, they're saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And then at the end of the text, they're mocking him, saying, "He's the King of Israel." All right, if you're a sports fan, and you like watching football games or basketball games, you ever seen players mock one another? If before the game starts, one player on one team says, "We're going to win this game," and then at the end of the game they don't win, the other players mock them and say, "Oh, you said you'd win. You said you'd win." you mock people based on claims that they said that they think didn't really pan out the way that the person said it would happen, if all of that makes sense. So here's the idea. Jesus claimed to be the king. And kings throughout history have had the right to demand absolute authority over your life. In the ancient world, if a king didn't like something that you said or did, off with that person's head, and the king's words could make it happen. And here you've got Jesus, who doesn't seem like he's got the credentials, saying things like, unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. I'm the one who has authority. But the problem is that he's so ordinary. You know, you think if you lived in the first century and you would have seen Jesus doing miracles, it would be so easy to believe in him. And I'm just not sure that that's true. Because Jesus didn't fit the mold of a king. When I was in Nashville training with Barry Kircheville, there was a man that we had some Bible studies with, and he had some issues. And there was one time when I was on a late night run, and he was at a corner by David Lipscomb College. And he was yelling out at everybody that would walk by, and I took my headphones out, and I said, "Hey, Charles, what are you doing?" And he said, "I'm trying to be the best servant of God that God has ever had." And I said, "Well, that's interesting." And he said, "By the way, God has given me the authority to cast you into hell right now, if I wanted to." And I thought to myself, well, you're kind of crazy, because you're just an ordinary guy. Can you imagine Jesus saying, "I need to have authority over your life if you want to be right with God for eternity"? Well, that would be kind of hard to swallow. You know why I think Jesus suffered? Is because people ultimately didn't want to submit to him. You think you're the king? Look at you now. You don't have authority over us. You know, it's interesting. You think about modern day mockers like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, some of these atheists that you can read from. And it's interesting to basically hear their arguments. They're basically saying, "I don't believe in God and I hate him." Almost like you just intuitively know that he really does live and he does exist. But in passages like 2 Peter 3:3, it says, "Scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing." And I think oftentimes we look at a verse like this, or I've looked at a verse like this, and gone, "Yeah, that's right, we do have scoffers." But this text tells us the motive: following their own sinful desires. You know what the Bible teaches, I think, is one of the main reasons why people don't follow Jesus? Is because there's things that I want to do that I don't want the king telling me that I can't do. And since I've started seeing some of these themes in the Bible, it's changed the way that I've talked with skeptics and atheists whenever I've studied with them. When somebody comes to me and says, "Hey, I don't know that the Bible is really from God," or, "Hey, I'm not really sure that God exists," I always will tell them this. I'll say, "I am more than willing to talk to you about those kinds of things. I think those are great things to talk about. I think Christianity has got the goods when it comes to good arguments. But let me ask you this question first, and please be honest with me. Is there something that you know the Bible teaches that you don't want to have to give up that you love doing? Or is there something that the Bible has taught people to do that you just don't ever want to do?" And let me just tell you, in my experiences talking with people, when people get honest about that question, that gets to the root issue of why they have problems with the Bible. And all of these arguments that sound really sophisticated are just ways of trying to make them feel like they're legitimate in their unbelief. And I would suggest that understanding these ideas helps us know why the world hates us. We are messengers, we are ambassadors of the king that has authority over the world. And when we try to tell people, "Hey, you need to think about the Lord, you need to think about Jesus," and then people have knee-jerk reactions to that because they don't want to have to submit. They don't want the light shined into their sinful activities. Maybe you could think about it like this. Have you ever been to a restaurant before where the first person orders their food and they get a big, fat, juicy hamburger? And then the next person gets something that's not good for you. And then the next person gets something that's not good for you. And then, like, the last person goes, "I want to have a salad." And I guess salad eaters just have to talk that way or something. And everybody kind of swings and looks at the salad eater. And they start making fun of the salad eater. Why are they doing that? You're making us look bad. That's really why we're scoffing and mocking at you, because we don't want to feel like we've done something wrong. Why does the world hate Christians? Because we're doing the right thing, or we ought to be. And it makes people uncomfortable. And so next time somebody makes fun of you for being a Christian, next time a friend says, I can't hang around you anymore, know that it's the reproaches of Christ falling on you. It's not personal. I think this is why Jesus suffered. I think this is why we suffer, oftentimes in this world. But here's another lesson that we should learn from this, is Jesus' example in the midst of his suffering. Go over to 1 Peter chapter 2. This is not going to be on the PowerPoint. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2. And one of the ways, whenever I'm preparing sermons, is I try to see, how does one passage of the Bible reflect on this passage that I'm looking at right now? And so one of the things that we can learn from this scene that we're thinking about with Jesus' crucifixion, Peter will quote or reference this moment in Jesus' life and then give an application to an audience that I think is very timely for us today. But consider Jesus' example in his suffering. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 21 through 24. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. When you read through the totality of 1 Peter, we learn very quickly that the audience is going through suffering. And when you think of first century suffering, typically you think about, you know, physical beatings. In 1 Peter, what kind of suffering is the audience going through? What people are saying about the Christians and what people are saying to the Christians. It's mainly verbal. And by the way, when Jesus was on the cross, what kinds of suffering is emphasized? What people were saying about him and to him. Maybe the suffering of the first century is a little bit more relevant to our lives than we sometimes think. But try to think about what Peter is reflecting on with Jesus' interactions with these people. When he was threatened, he didn't revile, he didn't threaten people back. When people were making fun of him, and people were not treating him the way that they ought to, Jesus did not fight fire with fire. I want you to think, in 1 Peter, why in this context, in this part of the book of 1 Peter, does Peter bring this up to the audience? I want you to go back in 1 Peter chapter 2 and look at verse 13. Look at 1 Peter 2:13. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. Here's one of the reasons that Peter says this in this context. Have you ever felt like you've had to suffer because of the government? I have to tell you that the elections a couple years ago was so disheartening. With the kinds of things that I saw Christians posting on Facebook, and the kinds of ungodly things and sinful attitudes that were expressed. You know what this is saying in this context? You feel like you're suffering because of the government? You better watch your mouth. Because what did Jesus do on the cross when he suffered? When people were threatening him? When we get threatened with more taxes? Whatever threat we might feel like we're facing, do we fight fire with fire? And sinfully interact with others with the way that we talk. But skip down in this context and look at verse 18. 1 Peter 2:18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. I know that there's some differences with the slave relationship and the kind of work relationships that we have today. But the parallels are still there. Do you ever complain about your bosses at work? I know that John the Baptist called out the sin of King Herod. It's one thing to call out the sin of somebody, but it's another thing to start judging the motives of other people and thinking that you understand the reason people do all the things that they do, and then you start justifying all kinds of sinful speech because somebody's not treating you in a way that you feel like you ought to be respected. You think about Jesus' example. On the cross, all these people mocking him, and he does not sin with his tongue. Skip down to chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, wives, be subject even to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. In this context, you've got some women who are married to non-Christian men, and you can imagine that this would be a sore spot in somebody's life that might cause them to say all kinds of mean and rude things to their spouse. And in this text, the wives are supposed to try to win their husband over without their mouth. Now, that they're supposed to explain the gospel, obviously, but they're not supposed to be nagging. They're not supposed to be using unrighteous speech to try to beat somebody into submission when you're suffering. One of the easiest things to mess up on is our speech. And maybe I could say it like this. If you were to squish a bug, what comes out of a bug? It's called bug guts. That's what it's called. If you were to take an orange and squish an orange, what comes out of an orange? Orange juice. If you feel like you're pressed in by the world and you're suffering, what comes out of you? And let me suggest that whatever comes out of you was what was something that was already there. But the suffering is just revealing what was always there. How is it that Jesus on the cross could maintain that kind of composure? How did he do it? You see in this text in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 23 that he continued entrusting himself to the one who judges justly. You want to know how Jesus, who could have just sneezed and everybody would have died, how did Jesus maintain his composure? He continued entrusting himself. I guess one of the things he kept telling himself is that God is the judge, God is the judge. Now, we know ultimately Jesus is going to be the judge, but in that moment, judgment didn't belong to him. It was going to be given to him at a different time. But do you want to know what's going to help us get through our suffering without trying to repay evil with evil? Is to constantly tell ourselves, God is the judge, God is the judge, God is the judge. You remember growing up? When brother or sister would hit you or take a toy away from you or whatever. And then mom would say, mommy would say to the one that was hurt, you just wait till daddy comes home and then he's going to take care of this problem over here. And then the kid who was mistreated could immediately start to take comfort, knowing that it's going to be handled righteously and it's not his job anymore. Daddy's coming home one day. He's going to take care of all the wrongs anybody's ever done against you. It's not our job to fight fire with fire. God is the perfect judge. But notice one final lesson from this scene. We've seen why Jesus suffered, Jesus' example in suffering, but I think we need to also understand what Jesus gained in the midst of his suffering. People say, no pain, no gain. What is it that Jesus gained? Look at Hebrews chapter 12. This is another text of the New Testament that reflects on this moment in Jesus' life. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3 says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him, or think about this scene in the Gospel of Mark. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. So far in this lesson, we've talked about the external sufferings that we go through, the way that people will mock us, and how that's part of taking up the cross. But do you notice part of the suffering of the Christian is laying aside every weight? Those are things that are not inherently wrong, that can pull us away from the Lord. Things that could be inherently okay, like working out, or politics, or your job. All kinds of things that seem okay, inherently. But then he talks about sin specifically. To lay aside those weights, because you're running a marathon. You don't see people wearing those weighted jackets when they're going to run a marathon. He says, put those things away. That is just nonsensical. You want to know one of the ways that we suffer, one of the things that the cross represents? It's not just externally what people say about us. It's the internal battle of putting away sin. I believe every Christian, every week, every day should understand what it means to suffer for the Lord. Because there's moments where we want to think things that are sinful, that we want to say things that are sinful. And sin promises momentary pleasure, otherwise we would never be attracted to it. And what the cross demands of us is that we crucify those momentary pleasures and we suffer in the moment because we didn't indulge. We have to go ahead and suffer in those kinds of ways. And Jesus, when he's on the cross, he's suffering externally, and I think he's suffering internally. But here's the critical question. What was Jesus thinking that helped him get through it, other than the fact that God is the judge? Did you catch it in this verse? In verse 2, the joy that was set before him. Now, I have a question about that. What was the joy that was set before Jesus? You might be thinking about John 17, the high priestly prayer of Jesus, where he talks about being glorified with the Father, like with the same glory he had before he ever came into the world. Maybe the joy set before him was being back with the Father. Maybe. I think that's probably part of it. But here's a question. Did Jesus gain anything in his suffering that he did not have prior to his suffering? The church. You, me. You know how the Bible ends with marriage? The spotless bride of the Lamb that was purchased, that he gained from his suffering. So, what was Jesus thinking when he was on the cross? This suffering that I'm going through right now is going to prepare a bride for me. And I have to tell you, I was really excited to get married. I have a wonderful wife. And if that my human experience is consistent with who God is, he's really excited to be with us. And one of the things that helped him get through his suffering is because he wanted you. Now, what would the joy that set before us be then? It's being with our groom. And I have to think that while Jesus was on the cross, he started to get a little taste of that joy. Do you remember the two robbers? I'm about to say something that might sound wrong, but think with me about this. When Jesus was on the cross, there was one robber on either side of him. I would suggest that there were actually three robbers that day. Jesus is flanked by two unrighteous robbers, and Jesus is in the middle, and he's the righteous robber. You remember in Mark chapter 3, where Jesus talks about entering the strong man's house and plundering back his goods, taking back from Satan what always belonged to him. You know what Jesus is doing on the cross? He's stealing back from Satan what was always his, with the thief on the cross. The question for us tonight is whether or not what Jesus has done for you has really stolen your heart. Has it gripped you? So that you're not a lethargic Christian. So that you want to zealously serve him. How do you get a Christian to become activated to serve God like they ought to? How does it happen? Behold the love of God. Look what he did for you. And if that doesn't circumcise your heart, if that doesn't put God's laws in your heart, if that doesn't remove your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, I don't know what else will. If you need to think about these things tonight, if you need to consider what this all means for you, if you need prayers or the help from the congregation, this is an opportunity to receive that. You can either come forward while we sing or meet with somebody or talk to somebody before you leave. But please understand that this is a room filled with people that want to help you know more about God. And if there's anything we can do tonight in that regard, please take advantage of that while we stand and while we sing.